Hello and welcome to Cancria, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And we are so thrilled to be joined by Heather Kitchen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it's really fun to be here.
Now, your career is, I've had the pleasure of seeing your work through the lens of what I do with community radio. I think you've been a judge on our awards for a number of years, specifically judging the Out Loud Awards, which is the LGBT programming. Do you want to tell us very quickly what work you normally do?
Sure. Well, I mean, in terms of my broadcasting career, I started working in commercial radio when I was still a teenager. Then I went into the music industry, but started doing community radio, specifically an LGBT program on CITR called Queer FM, which I did for 17 years. And whilst doing that, I was also contributing to the syndicated LGBT show in Los Angeles called This Way Out, which you might have heard of. And then Sirius XM Satellite Radio started a queer channel, a queer talk channel called OutQ, which I don't think exists anymore. But for the first decade, they actually had a Sirius news department that was run by a guy named Tim Curran, who's now at CNN. He was a great guy. And so I freelanced. I was like one of his Canadian stringers for about 10 years. And for the past just over six years, I've been in Thunder Bay working for CBC. So this is about the unqueerest media portion of my career I've had.
Now, it's funny you say you're in Thunder Bay. CILU-FM, which is, I want to say Laurentian University, Lawrence?
Lakehead.
I don't know why you were looking at me for that.
I was trying to figure out what at Lakehead University, CILU, it has obviously Get Bent with Jen Bent. But we are actually, our show, Cancria, is broadcast at CILU in Thunder Bay. They're right one on. Of our syndicated stations. So if folks recognize your voice out on the street, this might be why. Although you probably wouldn't recognize you from the CBC, being that, you know, that's your job.
If we're talking about queer shows on LU Radio, we should also mention the Queer Radio Hour.
Yes, absolutely. Although I think I haven't heard too much from them. It's interesting that you mentioned Queer FM at CITR FM in Vancouver, and your unbelievable commitment of 17 years. We've been doing this for...
Technically nine, technically four.
Yeah,
what? It depends on how you count.
There's a bit of a discrepancy there.
Yeah, well, we have been doing radio together for about 9 years.
Oh, right.
But yes, we've been doing this project for...
This program
for four.
Yeah, so we're episode 178, nine-ish. I forget what the exact number is, but we've renamed a couple of times.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, 9 years doesn't really hold a candle to your 17. Were you doing weekly? Because that's a huge commitment.
Yeah, I was doing weekly. I had a co-host for most of that time. And I mean, it was kind of, I mean, probably a bit like how it is for you guys. I mean, it was kind of a fun, it became a bit of an outing. So no pun intended. We would do the show and then we had a dinner afterwards that like our friends would show up at. This seems to be a community radio thing. I don't know if you do this. I know other people that do community radio shows and it's like, and then everybody goes out for a meal afterwards and like all these other people show up. Like, is that a thing that happens to you too?
We actually do brunch before.
Yeah.
There
is a Greasy Spoon just on the corner, which has actually closed due to COVID.
Yeah.
Disappointing. We make a brunch together and we aim to record around noon, although it really depends on how long it takes to make brunch.
Yeah, when we were there with
Drake Jensen, the gay country singer.
He loved the place and just kept trying to drink more coffee. We had to like shuffle him out the door. Fortunately, his husband was there to be like, come on, go out.
Underlay.
The brunch beforehand is definitely a good way of, well, if anything else, because if we do have guests, we can get to know them and form a rapport and get relaxed and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So how do you think queer media has responded or changed due to the sort of COVID crisis?
Huh. Well, that's a difficult thing for me to answer because, of course, I'm not doing queer media right now. So I'm much more of an expert in how the regular media are dealing with it. I mean, I think, I can't answer that question for the queer media. I should really be asking you. I think one thing that is interesting to me just in general around the COVID crisis that we're not really talking about enough collectively, mainstream media and possibly queer media, you tell me, is, you know, like the parallels with the AIDS crisis and you know, what some of the lessons are that we can learn from that. And also, you know, it's very interesting to look at how our society and our leadership responds to a potentially deadly plague when it impacts the majority of the culture and not just a marginalized community. It's kind of an interesting social study.
Yeah, I mean, I'll jump on that before responding to the queer media question. I think when the crisis first started, you know, Dr. Fauci was, you know, really, you know, gnashed his teeth on the AIDS crisis. Like, that really is what, you know, he built a career off of, was handling that. But one of the things that we found was a part of the cultural legacy in the queer community of the AIDS epidemic is that disregard, that ignoring of the problem, the, you know, it's the GRIDS, the gay-related immunodisease, you know, it's just the homos dying, nothing to worry about. And that's sort of being left out in the cold, you know, left to die, essentially. And for the first, at the start of the epidemic, you know, as it really built up in the States and in Canada, a lot of AIDS workers were like, you know what, this isn't the same, because this time the government is taking it seriously. There is a response.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, there is these measures. And I say at the start, because I think what we're seeing now is in the context of the United States, you know, when Trump is saying things like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have died, and that is, you know, it's just is what it is. That sort of nonchalance disregard for all these lives lost is very akin to how the US handled the AIDS epidemic. So I think, you know, how they're managing it now strikes us, you know, a closer tone to how they handled AIDS than before. Canada's been fine.
We've generally tried to avoid, well, it's crass if you compare two very different things and don't give respect to each of them independently. So we have acknowledged the overlap, but we've also tried to distinguish the fact that these are pretty separate, because the AIDS epidemic, at least at the start, did kind of discriminate, because it was sexually transmitted. It was somewhat contained within a specific community, whereas COVID kind of doesn't care. It crosses all sorts of borders. But also the response is kind of interesting, looking at how different countries do it. And I mean, I don't want to talk too much about the States, but they definitely have an issue in their healthcare system that the whole thing is kind of based around, like, screw you, I got mine.
Yeah.
But that doesn't work with infectious disease.
Right. It's like NIMBY. Yeah. Not
yeah. Like if you're talking about, you know, cause there is sort of this attitude, and this is lesser in Canada. We're a little bit more science educated than the States is. And there's documentation on this, that Canada has a slightly better science education system. But anyway, like, you know, if you have diabetes, that's your fault, not mine. If you have heart disease, that's your lifestyle, not mine. You can get away with that kind of with some things, but when it comes to infectious disease, it's pretty indiscriminate. It doesn't matter if you're young or old or healthy or sick, it can get you. And you may have an unexplainable immunity or an unexplainable susceptibility. So it's like the idea of coming together as a community is very important when it comes to infectious disease, in a way that you can't do with things like, I don't know, like gout. Yeah.
It makes me wonder, you know, we are seeing that COVID-19 massively disproportionately affects Black and people of color in the States, and also here in Canada.
Yeah.
You know, and those are communities and cities that have been, you know, by the federal government, somewhat ignored. And in some states that aren't taking it too seriously, they were somewhat ignored. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious as to whether or not when we look back, you know, with that sort of retrospective vision, if those communities are going to have that same sort of cultural impact that the AIDS epidemic had on the gay community. You know, that feeling of being ignored, left to die, you know, disregarded. I'll be kind of curious to see if that legacy also exists there at that point. What's your take on it, Heather?
I mean, it will be interesting to see. I mean, certainly, you know, it wouldn't be the first time. I mean, we've heard that kind of sentiment expressed around things like Hurricane Katrina, for example. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. I think it's interesting that it's not something that's being talked about more now. And I'm kind of, I will be interested to see if it becomes a bigger discussion. And I mean, similar to also, you know, the disproportionate impact, obviously, on seniors and people living in care homes as well.
I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting. But, like, I think how we remember or how the queer community remembers the AIDS epidemic is very much a white man's memory of the AIDS epidemic. It was a lot of gay men that died, and the cultural impacts of that really affected gay men. We don't really hear too many narratives around what happened with trans folks at the time, although trans may not have been an identity that they particularly, you know.
Yeah, trans is still considered a medical term in the 80s anyway.
Yeah, so I mean, applying today's identities to the past gets tricky.
It's, yeah, difficult, yeah.
But, you know, I'll be kind of curious to see, you know, where the difference lies. Just to, you know, loop right back to the other question, though, one of the things I found with...
About the media?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
With the COVID crisis is that it essentially, you know, it brought everything to a halt. You know, everyone had to stop what they were doing. And we are unbelievably lucky to already own an at-home microphone.
Yeah.
Because you could not get a microphone for love nor money anywhere in the continental North America. Like, it's just, you know, unless you built it yourself, you're not going to have one for the next 5 to 6 months. And all of these volunteer queer radio shows really ran into that barrier almost instantly, because all of those workspaces where the volunteer programming's happened, they don't have, you know, a large swath of microphones that they can hand out and a policy in which to bring them in, sanitize, clean, and send them back out. So that's been something that queer media and the nonprofit field has had to react to very quickly.
It was 50% that and 50% absolutely no difference, because a lot of the queer media, especially in Canada, but like also some of the shows in the States, because the, I don't want to just say corporate, but like the larger media corporations, like even stuff like PBS and CBC, which are publicly funded or partially publicly funded, it depends on the context. A lot of people sort of gave up on the larger structures and just started doing their own thing. Like, podcasting has been very beneficial. YouTube has been very big for the queer community as well. So when the lockdown started, for a lot of people, there was just no difference. Mm-hmm. Like, the only thing that changed was now their audience had more time to catch up on their back catalog. So, I mean, it was, I mean, I, in terms of the public radio sector, because I remember you telling me about this sort of thing back in like February, March, that there were some radio shows that had troubles producing because they couldn't get access to recording equipment. But then you have other people where there is just like some of the things that I listen to, absolutely no change, because a lot of people already had something to record with. Maybe not a quality microphone like the one between you and I right now, but they may have had like the pocket kind that journalists would sometimes use, like the field mics. Phones have better microphones than we give them credit for, but it's not excellent. It's not necessarily media worthy, but if you're in a pinch and Amazon and the source have run out of everything online, it'll do for now.
We were talking, we broke good deals with the manufacturers. Like, we had to go that far up the chain to get these products. Now, I mean, we know that for commercial and public radio, every single correspondent in TV, radio, the whole shebang, are suddenly recording in their living rooms or their, you know, what have you. you know, I'm almost grateful for the small silver linings in this pandemic, and that really is Zoom. Because I don't know if you're aware of this, but I have really struggled because of the laws around recording people without their permission.
Yeah,
getting an app or some kind of interface that records two ends of a phone call.
Mm.
Oh my gosh, I was pulling teeth trying to find something that was decent quality and didn't cost a fortune to be able to record two ends of a phone call. And as a result of this pandemic, Zoom rolled out, like, you know, the barreling trains down the track with really great quality recording.
I actually had my first Zoom interview back in November, long before all this. Mm-hmm. Like, they had been around for a while, just bubbling away in the background. Like, the corporate world was using it, and that was about it.
Yeah. And then I think even Google Meets, they brought in their recording, you know, for free to a whole bunch of things. But yeah, the idea of having digital conversations and recording them has become ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Whereas before it was almost foreign, you know?
And there has been a lot of talk of, like, why have we not been doing this before now?
Yeah.
There is a benefit to having in-person meetings. In-person meetings are superior in most ways. But there are so many things where people travel across the world for a half an hour meeting that they could have just done this way.
I mean, it would be a challenge to have a chat with you, Heather, in Thunder Bay when we're in Ottawa, you know, a little bit of a distance away. I've actually been to Thunder Bay. It's a nice, nice city. Struggles with white supremacy. Who knew? But other than that.
But it does have the most awesome name of a Canadian city.
It does, yes.
And by awesome, I mean that in the original sense, like a name worthy of awe. Thunder Bay just sounds so cool.
It inspires all.
And it lives up to its name, too. Like, I would say probably the second month I lived here, it was raining outside, and I heard this sound where I thought that, like, a building somewhere within a block of me had been leveled by a gas explosion. And actually, that's just what a thunderclap sounds like.
Wow.
In Thunder Bay, in the midst of a really awesome thunderstorm, which we frequently get.
We're going to jump quickly to a song, and then when we get back, we'll be talking Pride. This is
Lido Pimienta.
Yeah.
The song is Nada.
Thank you. And we'll be back just after this.
Yo no me muevo. Yo te soy sincero y no le tengo miedo a la muerte. Si es que me quieres, aquí la espero de frente y sonriente. El dolor lo llevo dentro, el dolor lo tengo presente. Soy mujer de sangre, luna de tierra, sal y luna, sin pena, sin duda. El dolor lo llevo dentro, el dolor lo llevo dentro, el dolor. Todo lo que yo sentí, todo lo que yo viví, todo lo que presencia, no me queda nada. Todo lo que yo viví, todo lo que yo aprendí, todo lo que yo sufría, no me queda nada.
Hi, and welcome back to CanQueer, home of Canada's queer media. My apologies to Lido for just failing epically. And we've played Lido before, so I don't know why I failed. We are joined by Heather from Thunder Bay. Thank you so much for staying with us. I'm really kind of curious as to what you think of the changes to how prides have reacted to the COVID crisis. Now, for all our listeners and those who are, you know, follow the show, Pride really is that sort of, you know, it's gay Christmas. I mean, it really is.
Can be, yeah.
It's the one time a year where we gather, you know, it's political, it strikes a message, there's tears, there's joy, there's intimacy, all of these things all wrapped up in you know, a one-week festival of sorts. And from coast to coast to coast, with the exception of PEI, they've all been cancelled. Of course, PEI was the only one that didn't cancel.
They're an island, though. They it's easier for them to control their...
This is true. They got on that bubble fast.
Yeah.
but yes, I mean, what's your take on how they've been forced to take an incredibly in-person event and digitize it?
I mean, I think it depends on the pride. Like, I would be curious. I know what happened in Thunder Bay. What happened in Ottawa?
Well, we haven't had ours yet. It's actually this coming week.
Yeah.
And they have a whole bunch of, and a lot of what the pride seem to be doing is sort of online workshops, online gatherings, online drag shows, and how they tackle the parade element seems to have differed from one place to the next. I think it was in Halifax where they just had like a steady cam following all of like five people doing the actual march, five spaced out people. For that, because for Halifax, they wanted that continued symbolism of there always being a march. And I thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But then others have done sort of a montage of different performances, clips, speeches, etc. What did Thunder Bay do?
Well, Thunder Bay actually did a really cool thing called Drive-By Drag, where you could pay money, excuse me, and a drag show would, a drag queen would come to your neighborhood and just like start performing on your street. And, you know, so it was all very socially distanced and stuff. So that was kind of cool. I thought that was neat. I mean, obviously you had to pay or make a donation. I can't remember exactly how they worked. So it wasn't for everybody. But you know, it was kind of a cool idea that actually allowed people to have something of an in-person experience, because I think that the the struggle, and I'm really saying this not so much just as a member of the queer community, but also somebody whose other job is and other career has been in the music scene, and who still edits a music website. Like music festivals and stuff are facing the same challenges, right? It's like the summer is when we have these big events that are like community events. It's like we get together with, you know, the queer community, and we get together with like at folk festivals and music festivals and stuff, and we have none of that. And I think the real challenge is that in the winter time, yeah, you know, getting together online kind of makes sense because there's nothing else to do. But in the summertime, it's like, you know, who wants to be sitting at home in front of a computer all the time? And so I haven't, you know, in the spring when the pandemic first hit, yeah, I was doing interesting things online and going to concerts online and that kind of thing. Since the summer hit, I really haven't done very much of that at all. I haven't really sort of felt motivated to go to an online pride, even though I could actually go to a pride that I can't normally attend because they are online. But yeah, I mean, I feel like I think we're still as a community and as many communities trying to figure out exactly how you create that substitute for getting together. And, you know, sometimes maybe we just have to admit that there is no substitute, and, you know, we're just going to have to sit back for as long as it takes to get a treatment or a vaccination for this thing, and then have like the best freaking party ever when we finally can get together again.
I think the post-pandemic pride is going to be just off the rail. Yeah.
But actually, in response to your question, the way you framed it, like how are prides reacting, there's actually two answers to that. The first is how is pride the festival? And the other is how is pride the organization? Mm. And a lot of pride organizations in Canada, I would say, have actually reacted in a very proactive way. A lot of them, because the pride organizations are the crossroads of their community. If nothing else, because they're organizing the festival, they have everyone's email and contact information.
They're the Rolodex of the local queer
community. They're the Rolodex of the community. You know, they know who to contact for what. So a lot of them have actually turned into resource hubs where they can actually help people connect with, you know, the social spaces, and, you know, this club can't organize, but this is where you would find the group.
Well, I think, well, I believe it was New Brunswick. We'll have to double check this, but I believe it was New Brunswick that had sort of a provincial-wide online hub that they created, and that was really born out of efforts to create shared provincial, you know, experiences online, because of course you couldn't meet in person.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that, you know, one of the things that we've noted before, and I think that we're seeing prides step up in a really cool way, because very often with the pride festivals, if you're not there on the day, you know, or you don't live right downtown where you can easily attend events, it's very, you know, you're not easily a part of what's happening. But when it's online, you know, you're reaching somebody in those far-flung suburbs, you're reaching somebody out in their rural communities, you know, those who normally would not be able to attend because of, you know, childcare, travel, you know, just not being in the vicinity, they have an opportunity now that they wouldn't before. So I think it's almost, you know, egalitarian, the sort of online approach.
We're kind of all equally screwed together.
Yeah, yeah. And I also, I think this has been a really cool reset on the hyper commercialization of Pride. You know, we did get, you know, Nike put out their Pride thingies, and you could buy your gay Budweiser with like the rainbow flag on it, and all of these things. A lot of those companies still did their usual shtick, but the actual Pride parades wasn't just a montage of bank, 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 grocery store, bank.
You can also tell the difference between companies who've been doing it because they wanted to or because they believed in it versus people who are doing it for cheap advertising. That, like, the various beer companies, because Bose Brewery, which is here in Ottawa, they went to Pride and said, we want to make a Pride line and we want to donate the proceeds to, I can't remember who they donated.
I believe there's a brewery in Thunder Bay that also did that. I think just this year there was a Thunder Bay, we talked about it on the show, there was a Thunder Bay brewery that created a beer just to help promo Do you know the remember the name of it?
Yes, that would be the Sleeping Giant Brewery.
So for me, one of the things is, you know, with the parades, they've now massively refocused it on the community.
Yeah.
You know, if you are going to spend an hour or two watching your laptop for this pride thing, you know, you're not going to get as many blasted ads as you would get if you were physically stood there. Now, one thing that, you know, I look forward to and always brings a bit of a tear to my eye is PFLAG and the sort of symbolic importance of PFLAG marching in the parade. And there's such a sort of an emotional reaction to being in that space and seeing certain people marching, you know, or being in the march yourself and engaging it. And I think that sort of physical presence, those elements which can't really be recreated online, I don't think I'd have the same reaction if I just saw like a 2-minute clip of like some PFLAG people talking.
Which is a logo.
Yeah. You know, I don't think that would happen. So I think we're missing that a bit this year. What do you think? Do you think the human element might be lost a little?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think just a little, I think a lot. I've really been thinking a lot about that in terms of not just Pride, but music festivals and all that kind of thing. And I really pay attention on the music side of things to like what is actually giving me that. Like, is there any kind of expression that is giving me some kind of replacement for that? And I think, you know, what it is it's not so much the live stuff that's streaming online or the workshops or the let's do a pride parade on the internet and like, you know, shoot pictures of whatever. I think it's really when people create media that actually captures the audience. So I can give you a couple of examples. The Edmonton Folk Festival this past weekend released a movie called The Hill. So this past weekend would have been the Edmonton Folk Festival weekend. And instead what they released was essentially a 2-hour concert film. And all it is clips of famous people performing at the festival and clips of the audience doing what the audience does and just all of the sights that you would see at the festival and some interview clips with the volunteers. But, you know, in the same way that when you watch a concert film, you actually do start feeling like the energy of the concert. I found that watching the Edmonton Folk Festival film actually gave me that sense of connection to that kind of festival feeling that I hadn't gotten just from watching live streaming concerts or whatever. I mean, live streaming concerts can be good, but that was really, that worked for me. And then there's a band called Sultans of String that put out an album of music where they collaborated with a lot of immigrants and refugees. They're kind of a world music band. And they put out a video for their song, I'm Free. And all it is they had like, probably like 1,000 people across the country just hold up signs saying what they missed from the pre-COVID era. And that's the whole video is just that. But it's a very sort of joyful song. And again, like that was like, it was just like, it was the music's nice, but actually seeing other people, not the band, but other people in the same boat was also really uplifting. So I guess I'm kind of feeling like maybe we need to start experimenting with like, it's not so much that, I mean, it's great to see the drag queens, it's great to see the decorated floats, but can we figure out a way to do it so we also see each other? Mm-hmm. Like, you know.
Because the spontaneity of both actually music festivals and of Pride, the ability to walk down the street and spot someone you haven't seen in a long time. Or with music festivals, we've interviewed the Peptides so many times that multiple times I've just walking down the street run into the keyboardist, the guy with the blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
And we recognize
you. Stop running into people. It's well, very rude.
Anyway, we'll recognize each other. Be like, hey, how are you doing? And then instantly we just start talking about music. Mm. You know, who are you listening to? What's new? What's interesting? What's old? You know, there's a Canadian band that sounds almost exactly like Heart, but slightly better. And I told him about that. He's like, that is impossible. You need to write this down for me right now. Like that kind of thing. Or even just going at Pride and being like, I like your shoes, to a total stranger. Little things like that, I think, bring people together a lot better than watching a video of sort of a local celebrity or a local person of interest. You know, it's the, I don't want to say little people, but little people. That's what makes it, that's what makes these events better.
You know, we have spoken before on the show that my personal favorite, and I think you're agreed, my personal favorite pride, and I have been to many a pride, is small town prides. And I imagine Thunder Bay probably falls on this side, is where, you know, it's a little bit of a march, but then it ends up in a park or in a picnic or in, you know, a public place and people are hanging out. You've got your drag queens in 30 degree heat with melting faces. You know, it's, you know, it's messy, it's hot, it's like, but it's fun, it's ma familia, it's, you know, it's just, it's all about that community building. Whereas the really big ones, and even now we're starting to see like Ottawa edging in that way, it becomes impersonal. You know, you're, it's almost like you're watching a play or theater production of this parade marching in front of
you're
you.
You're an observing audience.
Disconnect.
Not a participant.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the problems that Toronto has been running into
for a long time.
Over the past like 20 years, it's been gradually moving more towards like a, an audience point of view of, you know, you are here to watch other people who are more famous than you, even if it's just locally famous, having a good time. You're there to observe that. And it's not as interesting as a sort of family picnic aspect that a lot of smaller prides can have.
Or you've committed to the 30-kilometer march. And you're actually in the parade for Toronto. We're going to jump to Dead End by Lights and Myth, and we will be back just after this.
It was a cheap shot and I'm sorry. All the money in the world doesn't buy your faith. Don't worry. Trying to lose me, it ain't easy, but you're doing a good job keeping your back up, tearing my heart up, picking it all up. I keep trying. I don't wanna believe it. Keep on driving, trying not to see that.
Chasing you further.
Hello and welcome back to Can Queer. My name is Luke Smith. I forgot who I was for a hot second.
And I'm Sebastian.
Thank you. And we're thrilled to still be joined by Heather. Thank you for staying on the line with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's fun to hang out with you guys.
Now, one of the things that we've spoken to in the past is, you know, and I use this story that in Nova Scotia, for the Conservative leadership race, the mayor of, I want to say Cape Breton, it was one of the Capes. He was running for the provincial Conservative leadership, and he was being threatened with being outed. Like, he was being blackmailed for being outed. And I think it's insane that anyone is being threatened with being outed
in current year.
This was a couple of years ago, but not that many.
Yeah, I think it was like last year.
Or the year before, yeah. At latest. But other than, you know, CBC Halifax, no one else talked about it.
Yeah.
Like, we have a bit of a dragnet on all queer stories across Canada. Like, if someone posts it, we usually pick it up and then respond to it. And we're finding that sometimes it's small local papers, sometimes the local CBC that will pick up on things. Mm-hmm. But there's no conversation. There's no national conversation. There's no, you know, if you're not in that town at that time, you're never going to hear about it. So when we're talking about things like the flags, you know, there was that small town in New Brunswick which raised a straight flag for all of 16 hours before the world descended on them. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been a whole string of towns in northeastern Ontario, you know, including the town of Emo and a couple of others, which did or did not raise the flag, mm-hmm. and the kind of various debates about them. And they all seem to be happening in isolation, you know, almost completely cut off from the rest of the province or the rest of the country, or even the discussion happening nationally. We seem to be, queer news is so isolated to, you know, individual towns that the common thread seems to be lost. You know, when we're hearing a story about, you know, the college, University College of the Redeemer in Hamilton, yeah. You know, that runs so closely to the story about, that university in BC,
yeah,
which I forgot the name of.
Ascension or something like that.
Yeah, it'll come to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think...
You mean Trinity Western?
Yeah, that's the one, not Western, the other one.
Trinity yes. Western.
But, I mean, it's... It, I don't know, it just sort of frustrates me that there's a lack of queer media nationally that's able to pull these threads together.
Or when it does... It's a clear instance, because this was we ran into this with the East Coast town with the straight flag story, where it was most people who did cover it. It was a clear instance of tut tut, these people aren't as enlightened as we are. But the moment you start digging and you start getting into the context and the details and the follow up, because quite often there's no follow up when people do cover these stories. It was like the city council, they just didn't know. Somebody went to them and said, "Could you do this flag?" And they're like, "Oh, all right, sure." And then somebody else came along and said, "That might be offensive." And they, okay, we're sorry. But that follow-up of 2 days later, they took it down again and apologized.
Well, 16 hours, it wasn't up that long.
Well, that's a very important piece of context. And just reporting like, oh, these poor backwards small towns who don't know what they're doing. I see that a lot in the media, where if there is coverage, it's kind of negative. But then you follow it up and you're like, oh, like the Emo story where...
Town of Emo, yeah.
It didn't go very well, but then the follow-up with the rest of the community coming together and saying, like, what is wrong with their city council? That is an important piece of context mm-hmm. that did not get as projected as the initial story did. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there is... I don't know, I'm just sort of echoing your frustration.
Yeah. The CBC does a lot of heavy lifting on these small-town queer stories. Mm-hmm. And I think without the CBC's network in place, community radio can only do so much. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all volunteers. We haven't broken a story in a little while because we just don't have the time.
Although we have.
We have broken stories.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's always, you know, you look at the question of, what's the significance of, like, is it important that you provide this context? Why would it be important? You know, I think certainly there are lots of times where providing more context, not just in the situation of LGBT stories, but, you know, when it comes to stories around systemic racism and that kind of thing, there are times when, you know, having the time to research and provide more context would be appropriate. But it's really on a case-by-case basis. I'm not sure. You guys tell me. At this particular juncture in society, where we actually have 25-year-old case law saying it's illegal not to declare pride if you customarily provide proclamations to other organizations or events, yes, it's insane that it's still happening sometimes. I don't know, is it important? You know, is there important context to tie it together? What do you think?
Well, I'm going to just call back to the rant I had in that particular episode, because I was actually at, we recorded it first, because news story went over a couple of weeks. Mm. And the first time we recorded it, I was actually visiting family in Oakville. And my mom's like, you're kind of mean to those, you know, the protagonist narrative. And I'm like, so my rant was, it wasn't just emo. It wasn't just, and there was a couple of other stories at the same time. There was around that time, there was a lot of organizations butting up against the gay community because they refused to say the word gay. Mm. It's like, oh, we're welcoming of all peoples. Like in the emo case, the proclamation had gone for a couple of years being like LGBT community, gay community, but this particular iteration of council stripped any and every reference to gay.
Yeah.
Because by saying the word gay, we recruit. I don't know what they thought of it. You know, it's like, you know, maybe it's like the equivalent of Macbeth, you know, I don't know. But I mean, or Beetlejuice, if you say gay three times, a homo will magically appear.
Or you'll become one.
You'll become one. Yeah famously. Now, and it irked me because it was sort of a narrative emerging in all these separate stories that for me spoke to this almost cultural question that we have across Canada. Why is it that the new politically correct approach is to not even mention the gays? You know, we respect all diversity, but we won't be caught dead saying we accept and welcome the gays. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, with that emo case and what ties into my question around that sort of national discussion, is that's not good enough. And I think our show has so much more latitude for outrage compared to the CBC.
Yeah.
You know, very often we can go, wait, no, that's not right. Like in the case of the Canadian Museum of Human Rights and the fact that they made LGBT exhibits at the Human Rights Museum.
Optional.
They made LGBT exhibits optional.
Yeah.
I'm like, how can we trust you to take care of our history when you can deem when it isn't, you know, optional? And furthermore to that, have you even apologized for this now that you've acknowledged you did it? And, you know, a couple of days later, they did send the apology over to us. But it's like, you know, we have that capacity to be outraged and draw these dots together accurately or inaccurately, where the CBC, I think, doesn't have that same runway.
Well, I think actually Heather's point about time is also there, that we can spend the time talking about these things. So like when we were talking about emo, there's a small town near emo that basically said, like, on that flagpole, it's municipal flag, provincial flag, federal flag, end of list. We don't have the manpower, the resources. We don't have the available time to switch that flagpole all the time. And the two of us were like, it's everyone or no one. And those are both valid decisions, but sometimes some people, but not people we don't like. Like that's fishy.
Cherry picking.
Yeah. Or even just like there's a flagpole out in the garden for stuff like that. It's not ideal, but it's nice. And if that's included in the story, then that's something we need to know, because that's useful context if you have the time to talk about it, which sometimes you don't. You've got, what, 400 words or 30 seconds? I guess it depends on the medium. Depends on whether it's per page or not. I don't know.
Yeah. But I mean, I think, you know, you're getting at one of the sort of fundamental differences between mainstream media and community media, which is, you know, mainstream media, the way that it is kind of structured right now doesn't really allow in the same way for conversations about the kind of structural oppressions that exist in society. Yeah, like, so, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of how it is. And when you work in mainstream media, those are the parameters that you operate within. So, you know, you're telling one story here. And yes, of course, you know, you try to put relevant context in, but people have, you know, differing ideas about what is relevant context. I mean, you know,
I mean, I think
there's so many possible directions you can go with a story. Mm. And, you know, you have to make choices on the fly sometimes. Well, most of the time.
I think we also have the latitude to be able to refer back. You know, we have that space to be like, oh, you know, in regards to that emo story, you know, I was told by the chair of the board of the Emo Pride, the Border Pride, who happens to be a lawyer, along with his husband, who is also a lawyer, that they're suing the town of Emo to the Canadian Ontario Human Rights Commission, you know, very, very specifically on that.
Yeah.
And their goal is not necessarily to punish the town of Emo, but to set a legal precedent that applies specifically to small towns. And I think that'll be interesting. But I mean, is that worth, you know, is that going to be the news of the day that makes the cut on commercial and public? Maybe, maybe not. Is that something that we can refer back to? We have a lot more room there to do so. Do you sometimes miss having the kind of leeway that you would have had in Queer FM when reporting on these things?
I mean, I made a choice to become a mainstream reporter when I did, because I felt like I had worked in community radio for 17 years because I wanted to have the right to have an opinion on my human rights. And up until a point, I still reserve that right. My human rights are a lot less controversial than they were 30 years ago. So, you know, at the point where I left Queer FM, I was really feeling like, okay, you know, there were mainstream journalists when I was working in community radio who helped to facilitate the kinds of conversations that we have in society that helped to solve problems for marginalized groups, and in our case, solve problems for the LGBT community, and helped, yeah, facilitate that dialogue between LGBT people and people who at the time did not support our rights. And I felt like, you know, it's time for me, now that I've had my time, to help facilitate those conversations in society for other people. I don't particularly miss it. I mean, I lived, you know, through the era when we had no human rights, and I feel pretty privileged where I am right now. I mean, I'm white, I'm able-bodied, I'm middle class. I don't suffer a lot of intersectional oppression. And so, you know, it's kind of time for me to give back and make contributions for other people. You know, obviously, the mainstream media, it would be wonderful if some of the conversations that are happening now around, you know, how you deal with structural oppression in media organizations, how you report on things, you know, end up bearing some fruit in terms of how we cover stories related to marginalized communities. But do I miss doing community radio? No, I think I like what I'm doing now. I mean, I loved what I was doing at the time, and it's got me where I am, and I like what I'm doing now.
You know, I think we're almost at the same point. Like, we did this because we noticed that there was a gap in the conversations, you know, in the Ottawa market, and then, you know, in many communities. Like, we're syndicated in a lot of rural and remote communities.
Yep.
And in a lot of those communities, these conversations don't happen, and we insist every episode on having these conversations.
Or if they do happen, they don't happen in this manner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not often queer folks talking about queer issues. It's, you know, folks talking about queer issues who may or may not be queer. But I think that there is a need now for queer media to have a bit of a reckoning with systemic racism, to have a bit of a reckoning with who is telling these stories about queer history and queer news of the day, what stories are or are not being talked about. You know, and it'll be interesting. I think queer media continues to evolve. But I think the need for it, you know, you mentioned, you know, 30 years compared to today, you know, rights aren't where, you know, where they are. But there is not a single week that goes by where there is no news story for us to talk about. You know what I mean? There's always something happening in Canada that, you know, we need to look at and discuss. Like in Calgary, they had like 3 hate-related incidents all at the same time just this past week or so. And that's a whole thread to unravel. But, you know, so there's always something happening. Well, What are your thoughts? Do you think queer media has a vibrant future or a reckoning on its hand?
I hope so. I mean, I think that who creates the media is changing. You know, another reason that I left Queer FM when I did is because I really felt like the way things were going, it was no longer appropriate for, you know, a white middle class, you know, able-bodied, cisgender queer woman to be hosting the queer radio show anymore. Like, there was so much work and so much conversation that needed to be had on trans issues, on issues facing Indigenous people within the queer community. And I kind of wanted to like open up that space for that to happen too. And I felt like so many of the stories to be told in the queer community now and in the queer media are not my stories anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for the time that you've spent with us in this conversation. I've enjoyed it. I think it's been a great chat.
Yeah, it's been actually very, very interesting hearing the I don't want to say more professional side, but I just did, of what we do.
yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Well, we're going to be playing out with Ostra's Your Family. Thank you so much again, Heather, for joining us. I've been Nick Smith.
And I've been Sebastian. Thank you for listening.
Ooh, no.